loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Brian Becker, and I'm joined in studio by co-host John Kiriakou. In our first hour, we take a look at two big stories. First, presidential attorney and former New York mayor Rudy Giuliani got himself deeper into trouble over the weekend, challenging the narrative of the president's other attorneys on the Stormy Daniels affair, on the Mueller investigation, and anything else that happened to pop into Giuliani's mind. Also, and maybe more importantly, one of the defendants named in the Mueller indictment of Russian entities charged for alleged interference in the 2016 election campaign surprised the Mueller team by actually appearing in court Friday, announcing that it will plead not guilty. The company asked for discovery of the Mueller team and documents underlying the indictment, and they asked for a speedy trial. A judge rejected Robert Mueller's pleas for a delay. This is a surprising twist in the ongoing Russiagate story. And then President Trump will announce, or says he will announce tomorrow afternoon, whether the United States is pulling out of the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, also known as the Iran nuclear deal. We'll talk about what that means for U.S.-Iranian relations, for the possibility of a growing confrontation in the Middle East.
But before we get to those two stories, we'll go over today's headlines, including five that we'll cover in depth in the second hour. First, President Trump today expressed strong support for Gina Haspel, his nominee to head the CIA. Her nomination hearings begin on Wednesday. Haspel faces an uphill climb because of her central role in the CIA's torture program during the George W. Bush administration. CNN reported over the weekend that Haspel offered to drop out of consideration for the job, but was convinced to stay in. Next, Lebanese voters went to the polls yesterday to choose a new government for the first time since 2009. Although official tallies won't be known until later this evening, early results indicate a decline in support for the Western-backed Future Movement, led by Prime Minister Saadel Hariri, and gains for Hezbollah and its allies. Then, today we continue our segment Education for Liberation with Bill Ayers, where Bill helps us look at the state of education across the country. What's happening in our schools, colleges, and universities, and what impact does it have on the world around us? And then the most vulnerable Republicans in the House of Representatives are talking less and less about the tax cuts they championed late last year, realizing that Americans don't seem to care about the issue. And this is after Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell said, quote, "If we can't sell this to the American people, we ought to go into another line of work," unquote. And finally, banks in Argentina on Friday raised interest rates to a whopping 40%, just 2 days after raising them to 30.25%. A week ago, they were 27.25%. The rises are aimed at supporting the peso, which has lost a quarter of its value over the past year. And in other headlines, a new fissure in Hawaii's Kilauea volcano erupted late last night on the Big Island. The fissure is 12 miles from the original eruption site in Leilani Estates. Due to its proximity to the volcano, housing is more affordable in that area, and many people have recently been moving in. Since Thursday, the volcano has destroyed at least 26 homes and has forced at least 1,700 people to leave their residences. One suspect has been arrested, of 20 accused, in an alleged April gang rape of a 16-year-old girl in New Delhi. Her family asked the village council to respond, and the body ordered the accused rapists to do 100 sit-ups and pay a fine of $750. The accused men then assaulted the victim's parents and set their house on fire in reprisal. The girl burned to death inside. Massive nationwide protests have resulted in local police detaining 15 more people and making the arrest. Oliver North has been named the new president of the National Rifle Association. North worked at the National Security Council under Ronald Reagan and played an integral role in the Iran-Contra scandal. Since then, he has reinvented himself as a right-wing political commentator and radio talk show host. George Zimmerman, Trayvon Martin's killer, was arrested today on stalking charges. The accusations include that he sent harassing and threatening messages to private investigator Dennis Warren in December 2017. Those are today's headlines. Next up is a conversation about the Mueller investigation and the chaos in President Trump's legal team. You're listening to Loud and Clear.
Loud and Clear.
But first, we want to turn to the latest in the saga, the Russiagate saga with Donald Trump. Presidential attorney and former New York mayor Rudy Giuliani got himself deeper into trouble over the weekend, challenging the narrative of the president's other attorneys on the so-called Stormy Daniels affair, the Mueller investigation, and anything else that happened to pop into his mind. Giuliani also said he would recommend that the president ignore any subpoena from special counsel Mueller. We're joined from New York City by Ted Rall. He is an award-winning editorial cartoonist and columnist. And we're joined from New York by Jim Kavanaugh. Jim is the editor of thepolemicist.net. Ted and Jim, welcome back to Loud and Clear.
Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
We want to talk about what Giuliani's doing, the new tact that seems to be developed by Trump's legal team towards Mueller. Some of the other issues that are impacting or could potentially impact the timing of the Mueller investigation, including its relationship to or the timing of its announcements related to the time period right before the 2018 midterm election. And we also want to stop for a moment in this discussion and talk with the two of you about the fact that one of the defendants in the Mueller indictment of Russia or Russians for alleged collusion or interference in the 2016 elections, Concord Management, has come into court on Friday, announced to the court that it intended to offer a non-guilty plea and demanded to see the information that was foundational to Robert Mueller's indictment. These are all big, big stories. But let's start first with Rudy Giuliani's new appearances and his tact, or I don't know, whatever he's doing. We're trying to figure that out. Let's start with you, Ted.
Well, Rudy Giuliani seems to be taking after his boss. He seems to have gone rogue, even by the president's telling of the account, where he says Rudy's a great guy but hasn't gotten his facts straight. Interesting turn of phrase. But Giuliani started out by going on Fox and saying that the reason that Trump fired Comey was not what, among the, to say the least, the reasons that had been offered previously that have been constantly changing. Then he went on, and more pertinent to this discussion, said that that he paid the hush money to Stormy Daniels, contrary to the story we've been, of course, talking about here on Loud and Clear for months about. And where we've kind of wondered whether it was really likely that Michael Cohen, the attorney, would have really taken out a home equity loan to pay $130,000 on behalf of his client and not requested repayment. Well, he didn't. He took it out, but he did get paid back from Trump. Giuliani pretty damagingly went on to say that just because of the timing of the payment, just days before the 2016 presidential election, that the payment was necessary in order to Stormy Daniels due to the timing. So the problem here is, of course, that this does come into conflict with federal election campaign law, which would tend to view this as a donation by Trump to his own campaign, well in excess of the statutory limits, which I believe are what, $5,000, I think? I'm not sure about that, but certainly far shy of $130,000. And so now Giuliani's been backpedaling that and saying, well, they weren't campaign funds, they were private funds. But Giuliani seems to be betraying a lack of understanding, or perhaps a willful lack of understanding of campaign finance law. It seems that, I don't know if anyone's ever gone to prison over this kind of violation, but certainly it seems like a pretty brazen violation, and most legal experts believe that to be true. So now he's in damage control mode, walking back the story as much as possible, but as these things often go, especially when you're with a kind of undisciplined personality like Rudy Giuliani or Donald Trump, he seems to be just digging himself deeper and deeper, and his credibility in the Trump camp and the Trump administration's credibility is evaporating by the second.
Yeah, Jim Kavanaugh, there's a great piece in the Washington Post today saying that that Rudy Giuliani is repeating seven mistakes that have brought down previous Trump advisors. And they're very logical issues. Number one, for example, he's overconfident about his standing with the president. And what they mean here is that Rudy Giuliani just has not accepted the notion that he's hired help. He's not a principal in the White House. He's just hired help. And then he goes on something like ABC's This Week with George Stephanopoulos. And he says this. I love this quote. I saw it yesterday live. I couldn't believe my ears. He says, "I'm focused on the law more than the facts right now. My issue is getting up to speed on the facts. I'm about halfway there." But then he's going on literally every Sunday morning show in America and speaking with authority.
I only know one out of every two facts, but let me talk about that.
And he professes to speak with authority, and he can't. So at the end of the day, doesn't this just hurt Donald Trump even more?
Here's another existential question, Jim. Is there something called an untrue fact?
Many. Yeah, it is. It's like watching the clown car of lawyers. Not the Dean Dream Team, it's the clown car. I mean, it's kind of amazing that Giuliani gets on television and says some stuff and that seems to hurt Trump, and then Trump says he doesn't know what he's talking about, and then Giuliani gets back on television and says, "I don't really know what I'm talking about, but let me say this, let me talk anyway," and says stuff that seems very harmful. Now, if there's a principle at work here, if there's a strategy on Giuliani's part, and I think he's been saying it, and that's what he means by "I don't care about the facts, I care about the law," he wants to get the legal pressure off of Michael Cohen. This at least makes some sense. He wants to get the felony campaign contribution, illegal campaign contribution charge off of Michael Cohen so that the prosecutor can't use that as a bargaining chip to get more information from Cohen about other things that are probably a lot of illegal financial shenanigans that Trump might have done that Cohen knows about. So what he's essentially been saying, "I don't care how politically damaging this is. I don't care whether he lies to the press. We'll deal with that in another way. But I want the legal thing," and it's really a message to Cohen, saying, "You don't have to worry about that legal charge. We'll take all the heat from that, and even all the legal heat for whatever illegal political contribution." Because what are they going to do to a sitting president over a legal political contribution?
Jim is right. That's yes. What this tactic was about.
That's right.
Poorly executed by Giuliani because he's so incompetent. But the whole goal of saying, look, Michael Cohen gets a retainer, $35,000 a month, and the president doesn't have to ask about how that money's spent. Some of it's for a little bit of Michael Cohen's profit. Other money is used basically as a disbursement fund to solve problems. And thus it doesn't have to be a conscious act by the client to use the lawyer to pay hush money. The client gives the lawyer money, the retainer, $35,000 a month. The lawyer does with the money what the lawyer wants to do. That puts an arm's length between the client, in this case Donald Trump, and what the attorney does with the retainer money, which is to pay back Michael Cohen for having given money to Stormy Daniels as hush money. But Giuliani, because he's
dissembling is what he is.
He says, but here's the reason we did that, so that Michael Cohen can pay back Stormy Daniels,
right.
Defeating the whole purpose of the maneuver.
And that was another thing that he was cracked on yesterday. It says here, Giuliani said that Trump told Cohen, "We'll cover your expenses," and agreed to pay him the $35,000. Okay, so George Stephanopoulos asked him about that yesterday, and Stephanopoulos said, "How do you explain this?" Here's a quote. "Those are the facts that we're still working on," Giuliani replied.
The 50% he still hasn't.
And that, as you know, may be in a little bit of dispute. This is more rumor than it is anything else. Stephanopoulos replied, "But that's what you said. You said it. You said that to BuzzFeed." "Well, yes," Giuliani said. "That's one of the possibilities and one of the rumors. But you stated it as fact," Stephanopoulos shot back. "Well, maybe I did," Giuliani said. "But right now, I'm at the point where I'm still learning. And I can't prove that. I can just say it's rumor. I guess I can prove it's a rumor, but I can't prove it's a fact yet. Maybe we will. I don't know how you separate fact from fiction."
Is your head spinning, anybody?
This is a lawyer. I mean, this is supposed to be somebody's lawyer on television speaking, doing something that will help his client. It's absolutely fantastic.
And I have to say, too, that when he goes on national television, it says that Jared Kushner is expendable, or disposable is the word that he used. You're not really putting yourself in the graces of the man who hired you.
That sounds like music to the ears of all the tenants who are being evicted by Jared Kushner's
sure does.
firm in Baltimore. But yeah, you're right. Like what you, this is the president's son-in-law, senior advisor, quote, disposable. I mean, here's the thing. Giuliani, you know, Giuliani became mayor of New York, a city that's 80% Democratic, as a Republican, because he was running against David Dinkins as an open racist with the support of the cops. He was leading racist rallies down in, you know, around City Hall and Brooklyn Bridge back in the day. Giuliani was kind of, for those of us living in New York and who were fighting against racism, you know, we thought of Giuliani, you know, to put it in vernacular terms, as nothing other than a thug who happened to win the election because he rode a wave of racism. That doesn't really mean he's a polished politician. That doesn't mean he's an effective lawyer. It doesn't mean he's an effective U.S. attorney. He's very effective at racist right-wing TV talk shows that Donald Trump is trying to marshal to generate support within his base. But that doesn't mean he has any semblance of competency. I mean, a truly overrated figure in all ways, but that's also part of the nature of American pundit politics.
Well, let's not forget also Giuliani's, if we want a little trip down Giuliani memory lane, that he tried to stay on for an illegal third term after 9/11. New York City had mayoral term limits at the time, a two-term limit, and so he was on the way out. It was 9/11 happened, and he lobbied in the media quite strongly to say that, well, you know, now that the whole world has changed, and I think the primary was actually held on 9/11 and sort of became a disaster. He said, well, I'm going to have to stay another term because, you know, obviously I'm needed. And all of New York, including Republicans, it was kind of just crickets. Nobody wanted him there for a third term.
And what did he really do after 9/11? I don't mean to sound cynical, but
go ahead.
He just went to a whole bunch of funerals. I mean, that's really all he did. There was no special leadership or anything.
No, but he got a lot of nice publicity for showing up on TV that day and looking strong and looking strong. That was a moment for him that did help him.
After putting the City Crisis Response Center in the World Trade Center.
That's right.
You know, I want to tell a little story. It's a real divergence, but it says a lot about Giuliani because I think this happened as a consequence of Giuliani. On the first day that Giuliani was taking the oath of office to become mayor for the first time after this racist campaign in New York, I, along with a number of other people, organized a demonstration against Giuliani's racism down at City Hall during the time of the inauguration. And as we were walking across the street, across Broadway, to go to City Hall Park so we could stage this protest, the police came up to me and a number of the other people who were they thought were organizers of the protest, and they came up and they said to me, you're under arrest. And I said, for what? And the cop said, are you resisting? And I said, no. And he said, well, turn around. So I turned around. They handcuffed me. They handcuffed three other people they thought were organizers of the demo and the guy who they thought was going to be running the sound system. And they carted us off to jail. And 5 hours later, after the inaugural ceremony was over, we were released with no charges. That's a true story. That's Giuliani. Giuliani functions like that. He's that kind of guy because I don't think I think the cops had instructions from the Giuliani team, don't allow any embarrassing disruptions to happen or protests. As it turned out, the protest went fine. It was big. It was strong. It didn't need these individuals who were arrested. But that's Giuliani. That's who this person really
is. It says a lot.
I want to turn to a different subject now, and that is that one of the defendants who was indicted in the Mueller indictment against Russia or Russians for interfering in the 2016 election, actually, and I think the Mueller team was not expecting this, went to court on Friday and announced to the court that it was planning to plead not guilty and then demanded to have discovery so that they could find out what the foundation of the indictment was all about. And I want to read something to you from the Daily Beast. This is written by Kevin Polson. Russian troll farm goes after Mueller files. Lawyers for Concord Management and Consulting are demanding a wealth of information, including the identities of informants and details of any electronic surveillance. Lawyers for the company accused of funding Russia's election interference trolls are demanding that special counsel Robert Mueller turn over reams of information, including the identities of informants, details of any electronic surveillance, and a list of, quote, each and every instance, close quote, since 1945, in which the U.S., quote, engaged in operations to interfere with the elections and political processes in any foreign country. The ambitious demand for legal discovery surfaced Friday in Mueller's criminal case against 13 individuals and three Russian companies linked to the Internet Research Agency, the St. Petersburg troll farm that used fake accounts to organize demonstrations on U.S. soil and flood American social media with alt-right memes during the 2016 election campaign. One of those defendants is Concord Management and Consulting. Now, they've hired the law firm Reed Smith, prominent law firm, and this Washington law firm made an appearance and demanded that that they were going to plead not guilty and demanded that the Mueller investigation provide them with information so that they could understand the nature of the indictment. The Mueller team is flipping out, demanding from the judge that this not go forward. They're even arguing in a bizarre kind of way that the summons for the indictment wasn't properly served. Of course, that would have been their job. Anyway, Jim Kavanaugh, you've read about this. This seems to me to be pretty big because I think Mueller in the indictment didn't expect any of the defendants to actually come to court. So the indictment would just be sort of a public relations stunt, but maybe it won't be.
Yeah, this is one of those things where be careful what you ask for. As you say, I think it was a stunt, a theatrical stunt. It was a media play. And, you know, all of the analysis of these so-called troll farms showed that's what they were. They were troll farms to generate clickbait revenue. But now they got one of them coming back and saying, yeah, well, let's have a trial. Let's have discovery. And, in fact, the issue, I think, in the court Friday was whether to postpone it. And Concord Management, no, we want our speedy trial rights. We want to go through with this, and we want discovery. And Mueller doesn't want to do that, obviously. I mean, they're even claiming national security information that they can't, you know, who are these secret informants or whatever processes they use. So it's a little bit of they've got themselves in their own trap a little bit. Now, I would be careful of that because I don't think anybody should rely on judges to do anything but favor the prosecution in these cases. But it's an interesting tactic, and even if it's what WikiLeaks said after the Democrats sued them, we can't wait to get into discovery on this. Because, you know, what are you going to ask for? You're going to ask for discovery. How did you find out about this? And even the Concord Management legal team saying, we want definitions of these terms, election interference, disparaging Hillary Clinton. What do these mean? We want to know exactly what we're being charged with.
Disparaging Hillary Clinton is like part of the indictment.
Yeah. So that's a legal charge. They're demanding that the prosecution define what it's doing. And, you know, I got to say also, this is, you know, this whole scenario demonstrates the corruption of the political process in general. I mean, all of the machinations you have to go through to get money and to try and make it look legal and evade campaign contribution laws. There's somebody who's suing the Clinton campaign for like $84 billion of funneling money illegally through to the Clinton campaign, which was supposed to go to state and the DNC, and who the heck knows what's going on with campaign contributions? This is part of the problematic of the corruption by money of the American political system in general, and they can selectively prosecute whomever they want on this.
Yeah, I'm looking at Politico. Ted Rall, in a brief order Saturday evening, U.S. District Judge Dabney Frederick offered no explanation for her decision to deny a request prosecutors, that's Mueller, made Friday to put off the scheduled Wednesday arraignment for Concord Management and Consulting, one of the three firms charged in the case. It's clear by the fact that Concord is coming into court saying we're going to plead not guilty, we want discovery, we want to go for a speedy trial, that the Mueller team did not anticipate this. And as a consequence, I don't disagree with Jim, we shouldn't rely on judges. I mean, this judge can rule one way, it can be overturned later. But what happens if Mueller wants to say national security prevents us from providing you with information that forms the foundation for our indictment of you? What do they do? Do they drop the indictment? In other words, if Mueller is forced to drop the indictment because they don't want to go forward and actually have a trial, doesn't that make it then look like Mueller only wants indictments of people who can't participate in legal proceedings? Even dropping one of these indictments, again, from the one party that wants a trial would seem to me to be very discrediting.
Oh, that would be a major, major setback, I think, for the Mueller team.
Go ahead, Ted.
It would look bad for sure. It would be some weak tea. It would look like they had some serious weak tea to serve. There's the thing about I was just thinking about defense counsel could always counter that anyway by saying, look, you're welcome to redact anything and submit any ideas for material that comes under a national security exclusion and should be omitted for that reason, or it could be stuff could be eyes only, and it could be seen in a this happens in trials where national security documents are sensitive documents are to be seen. Sometimes the lawyers can go in and examine them, but not copy them, they might not even be allowed to take notes on them. But they go into a secure room at Langley or wherever. So it's not like the court system, especially in Washington, is unaccustomed with dealing with classified information as it comes up in lawsuits and prosecutions. So it would be kind of silly to just use a blank. If they drop it under the blanket excuse of the national security argument, I think it's going to look really awful.
And again, I want to just emphasize for our audience, John, that the reason the Mueller team gave to the court, to the district court, for why they shouldn't go forward with a speedy trial for these hearings and then a speedy trial was the prosecution was arguing the U.S. government, this is a quote, the U.S. government has attempted service of the summonses by delivering copies of them to the office of the prosecutor general of Russia to be delivered to the defendants. That office, however, declined to accept the summonses. The government has submitted service requests to the Russian government pursuant to a mutual legal assistance treaty. To the government's knowledge, no further steps have been taken within Russia to effectuate service. So Mueller is now arguing that because they gave the summons not to Concord or Concord's lawyers,
right,
but to this Russian government office,
right,
and then the Russian government office, of course, isn't doing their work by serving the summons for them, that now the defendant doesn't have the right to go forward with a speedy trial. I mean, this is just such upside down sort of rationale. It doesn't make any sense if anyone's actually paying attention. Go ahead, Jim. You get the last word. 1 minute left.
Oh, yeah. I mean, the Concord is essentially saying, here we are. Who cares how you tried to serve the subpoena? Here we are. You know, don't try and delay this on an issue that has absolutely no relevance at this point. We've shown up in court. Voluntarily. Anyway, this is I think it does show the potential very fatal weakness of what Mueller is doing, and what Concord is trying to do is either push him to dismiss the case because he doesn't really have to go through with it, and the prosecution team doesn't want to spend the time on it. This is going to create an enormous amount of demand an enormous amount of time and energy that they'd rather do with something else.
Yeah, that's true. So the defendant is there saying, who cares about service when we're here, we're acknowledging it, we're pleading not guilty, it's not an issue. But Jim is right, John. I think this is potentially a very, very big issue.
I agree.
And I think it may be the reason why the New York Times, the Washington Post, I haven't seen anything that they've written about it.
That's right.
Even though it seems to be to open up an unexpected door in what comes next. Anyway, I think we're completely out of time. We've been joined from New York by Ted Rall. Ted is an award-winning editorial cartoonist and columnist, and we've been joined also from New York by Jim Cavanaugh. He is the editor of thepolemicist.net. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker.
And I'm John Kiriakou.
President Trump has promised to make a decision on whether he will pull the United States out of the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, the JCPOA, or also known as the Iran Nuclear Arms Deal, by May 12th. Most observers believe that he will pull out, but the fallout could be monumental. U.S. allies who do business with Iran would face massive sanctions, as would banks and individual companies. Trump's actions could turn the entire economy of Europe on its head, but does he care? We're joined from Connecticut by Ann Wright. She is a retired United States Army colonel, a former U.S. State Department official in Afghanistan, and Ann Wright resigned in protest from the State Department for the invasion of Iraq. and became an important, well-known, internationally recognized anti-war activist and organizer. And Wright, welcome back to Loud and Clear.
Thank you, Brian. Great to be with you.
Isn't it odd? Isn't it really, really odd that the United States government, as a government, could involve itself in several years of negotiations with multiple countries, the P5 plus one, that's the all the Security Council members, plus Germany, plus Iran, hammer out this amazingly detailed plan for inspections of Iran's nuclear energy program, whereby Iran allows itself to be subject to the most intrusive kinds of investigations from people coming from other countries, and giving up a big part of its already existing nuclear energy program so as to confirm, to verify to the world that Iran, in fact, does not possess and is not in the process of making a nuclear weapon. All of that work, and then to have somebody like Donald Trump make a determination, hey, this is a bad deal, you're not in compliance. It's just so odd, isn't it?
Yes. Well, it is very odd how this very comprehensive agreement with six countries has been totally dismissed by President Trump, as he did dismiss it when he was a candidate. So on one level, it's not unexpected what he's done or intends to do. On the other hand, it is very disturbing that none of his advisors, those people who've been in government for a long, long period of time, have not been able to convince him of the importance of keeping this agreement. It's very disturbing when you have all of these people who have spent decades of their life in the government who have, they may not all agree with all the aspects of it, but they know that it is a much safer way for us to proceed in the world to have this agreement. So it really is discouraging that none of his advisors have been able to convince him to keep this.
This is pure politics, John, because
yes.
Because anybody who's watching and observing, and there's lots of people doing and institutions doing just that, Iran is in compliance. The International Atomic Energy Agency is in compliance. Trump knows Iran is in compliance. I mean, it's not like he's uncertain.
Yeah,
this is not about the facts.
And one of the things I think most Americans either don't know or have forgotten, that this is exactly the same inspection regime that the United States imposed on Iraq through the 1990s, up until 2002 in the Iraq War. And it works. You know, there are seals that are on many of the facilities. There are cameras everywhere. And Iran has agreed to spot inspections whenever the international community wants to conduct inspections. They're in compliance. It's plain and simple.
The one thing, and John, is that this, in fact, even though Trump is the one about to rip up this agreement, it's not just Trump, though, because let's look at what just happened in Congress. New sanctions were imposed on Iran, which are contrary to what the U.S. agreed to with Iran. They can say it's for non-nuclear issues, whatever. The point was, the quid pro quo was, Iran was allowing this intrusive inspections regime. They were going to make it clear and verifiable that they weren't going forward with a nuclear weapons program. And in exchange, there was going to be an ending or an easing of economic sanctions so that Iran's economy wouldn't be so badly wounded by international trade under this sanctions regime. And yet the U.S. Congress passed by a vote of 419-3, and then in the U.S. Senate, 98-2, a bill that imposed harsh new economic sanctions on Iran, on North Korea, and Russia. And as a consequence, the European allies of the United States who wanted to do business with Iran and who favored this pact, a lot of them are not doing business even now with Iran because they don't want to be also punished as third parties by American unilateral sanctions penalties.
Yes.
And as a consequence, Iran is not deriving the benefits Iran thought it would derive from entering into this agreement. And this is before Trump cancels it. I mean, that's a part of this awful reality. And it seems like Iran or developing countries, when confronted with these ultimatums and demands, no matter what they do, they can't do enough, because the real point of the sanctions isn't to enforce a nuclear-free Iran. The point is to hurt and damage and subvert Iran as a country.
Well, indeed, and the, you know, the policy of regime change that the United States still has, whether it's for Iran, and we've seen it for Iraq, we see it for Syria, we've seen it for Libya, we see it for North Korea, although the Trump administration has now said that that is not the goal of the United States now, regime change in North Korea. But I wouldn't trust them too much on that. But the whole issue of, you know, going back 40 years with the taking of U.S. hostages in 1979, that still is such a raw thing for U.S. policymakers. And I don't think there's much that the government of Iran can do to get out from under that, particularly the revolutionary government that's there. The U.S., of course, is complaining bitterly that Iran's military influence, whether it be in Syria, in Iraq, in other places in the Middle East, is something that we must fear because they are interfering with the internal workings of another country, whereas it doesn't seem to bother our politicos that we interfere with everybody's internal functions of governments all over the world.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. It's a double standard that as Americans we just don't ever see or choose not to recognize.
You're looking at though a much different country than what the U.S. normally picks on and bullies. Iran that has over 80 million people, whereas Iraq had something like 28 million, and which is about what North Korea has. So you're looking at a much larger country, a much more developed country, militaries that are actually now very versed in military operations because of what they've been doing in support of the Iraqi government, in support of elements within Syria. So it's not like this is you know, the threat of military action that the Trump administration continues to use and all options on the table that the Obama administration said. Well, it's a very different table, in my opinion, that the Iranians are, they were tested in the 1980s in the war against Iraq, and then they've had their military forces in Syria and in Iraq, and I think our U.S. military probably is a little bit hesitant to even attempt to take them on.
One of the things that the U.S. government and the CIA may be considering, and I believe they are considering it, is to use the old tactic of economic destabilization as a precursor or a context-setting set of circumstances that allows covert operations to be conducted with the goal of regime change. And covert operations like that don't include just an invading U.S. military force or a British military forces. You take human beings who have discontent within the targeted country. They have discontent. They're unhappy about the economic situation, about growing poverty, all of the things that sanctions cause. And they want change. Whether they like or don't like the current government, they want change because they have to ultimately feed their families and they want their life to be okay. They want to have access to medicine. In 1953, in the case of Iran, the U.S. imposed very harsh economic sanctions. That happened in 1952 when the democratically elected government of Mohammad Mossadegh nationalized the Anglo-Iranian Oil Company, which was then now known as British Petroleum. And so the U.S., CIA, and British intelligence, after the U.S. and Britain imposed harsh economic sanctions causing economic dislocation, carried out a really bloody coup d'etat that overthrew the democratically elected government, imposed the Shah of Iran, brought him back to the throne, and then 26 years of tyranny, of monarchy, which only ended with the 1979 Iranian Revolution. Thousands of Iranians were killed, but the whole operation was covert. Kermit Roosevelt led it. He later went on to become vice president of Gulf Oil, Gulf Oil took 40% of Iran's oil after the Shah, having been imposed on the Iranian people by this coup d'etat, denationalized British Petroleum, and the British gave 40% of that oil to the U.S. market and Gulf Oil. Kermit Roosevelt was rewarded for his good work. Covert operations like that are still military operations, but by different means, John. I mean, you know about that.
Yeah, they are. You know, these covert actions so frequently throughout U.S. history have come back to bite us, sometimes generations later. If you look at the Iran coup, I mean, we're talking about something that happened 65 years ago, and we still haven't gotten over it. We haven't gotten past it because we so poisoned relations with Iran, and not just with Iran, but I mean more specifically with the Iranian people, that we've never been able to recover from that. You know, this is another thing too about the use of espionage and covert action in U.S. foreign policy. It's usually misguided. It's usually wrong. And if you look back, let's say just over the last half a century, it's been consistently wrong, and it's put us in an even more dangerous position around the world, whether it's in Iran or the former Soviet Union or goodness knows the Middle East and South Asia, even sub-Saharan Africa. We've just never been able to overcome these covert actions.
And Anne Wright, I want to talk about a little bit more about this and the prospects of more covert operations against Iran and try to understand. And I think John is completely right. I mean, maybe it fades as an issue from the American media, but the people, the targeted people, they don't forget. You know, a lot of people in the United States are convinced that the U.S. is going after Iran because it's the Islamic Republic. It's a Islamic fanaticism or whatever. But the United States supports Saudi Arabia, which is really a fanatical country and for the monarchy, a feudal, semi-feudal establishment. It's not really about the form of government in the targeted country. It's really about whether that country is independent from the United States pursuing its own policies. Anyway, what's your take on all of this?
Well, I agree totally that anytime that there's any sort of a government that doesn't go along with what the U.S. wants, for example, with the overthrow of the Shah of Iran, then they're in the target hairs of the United States, the crosshairs of the United States. And we've seen that in many different places. We talk about what has happened to Cuba. Here it is nearly 60 years that it has been after its revolution that's still challenging U.S. imperialism. We look at North Korea that has continued to challenge the United States regime change. And I've just come back from Vietnam, from 3 weeks being in Vietnam, and after the American war on Vietnam, as they call it, where after they defeated the French, after hundreds of years of French domination, and then the United States comes in to continue the colonialism, and finally they get the U.S. off, but even after the war and after the United States, by the Paris Treaty, was supposed to pay reparations of billions of dollars, the U.S. never did that. So any country that crosses the U.S. Has a long time ahead of it where memories do not fade as far as those who dare stand up against the United States.
That was the voice of Anne Wright. We're talking to Anne Wright from Connecticut. Anne is a retired U.S. Army colonel, former U.S. State Department official in Afghanistan. She resigned in protest of the U.S. invasion of Iraq in 2003. She is now an internationally recognized anti-war organizer and activist. We're also joined in studio by Walter Smolarek. He's a Sputnik news analyst and the producer of this show, Loud and Clear. Walter, Anne Wright's making an important point. It's not really about nuclear weapons. It's not about nuclear inspections. It's not about compliance. It's about the fact that the U.S. government under Trump has resorted to what the U.S. policy under earlier Obama, before the Joint Comprehensive Plan, and then under George W. Bush and under Bill Clinton, which was to overthrow the government of Iran. And that they needed the nuclear issue as a pretext to impose economic sanctions, which destabilize the country, which create the conditions, the objective material conditions for protest, discontent, regime change. I noticed in the Wall Street Journal front page today, Wall Street Journal, there's all this talk in the Wall Street Journal about labor unions and the rights of workers. You never see that from the Wall Street Journal because there's a wave of strikes going on in Iran. Again, because workers are suffering from inflation caused by sanctions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's the famous saying in the lead up to the 1973 coup, I think Kissinger was said to have made this remark that, you know, we have to make the economy scream, saying that, you know, there has to be economic conditions created, whereas, you know, consumer goods are not available or, you know, become more and more and more expensive and unattainable by the majority of the population. And only under these conditions, even if what actually institutes regime changes some type of military action, as it was in Chile, where the military took over. You know, the fact that the U.S., quote, made the economy scream was an essential precondition to such a final maneuver. So, you know, like we saw in Iraq, for instance, sanctions and, you know, direct military intervention can very easily go hand in hand. The, you know, fact that Iraq was completely blockaded, besieged for over a decade before the 2003 U.S. invasion was a critical factor in allowing the United States to be able to move in so quickly. Of course, they weren't able to consolidate their control over the country, but, you know, the initial success of the invasion had a lot to do with the sanctions that had been imposed for years and years and years before that. And yeah, I think the Trump administration is looking to initiate a similar type of maneuver here.
Yeah. And again, regime change, friends, is not because the United States wants a more democratic Iran.
Never.
It's not about that. They're going to say that. They can't say, oh, we want regime change so we can exploit the hell out of Iran. They can't say that.
And remember, regime change as a policy is illegal under international law. One of my attorneys mentioned this to me when during the campaign we were talking about President Trump's announcement that he supported regime change in Iran. And my attorney said, this is the first time I can ever remember a presidential candidate promising to adopt a policy that is an impeachable offense if elected president. And that's exactly what we saw. This is an illegal act to call for regime change.
And right, it's illegal, it's immoral, it's unethical. It's also a tool whereby the rich, the powerful, can impose their will on the weaker or more powerless. The rich and the powerful never have sanctions directed against them, no matter what crimes they commit. The U.S. can kill a million people in Iraq, but who's going to sanction the United States? It's a class tool in addition to all else. Go ahead.
The United States is doing to Yemen right now. No one's going to be held accountable for the horrific things that have happened to the people of Yemen because of the Saudis and the U.S. there. Nobody's going to be held accountable for all of the people that have been killed and all of the destruction in Syria by all sides. So it's certainly a double standard of how the U.S. operates in the world. We require other countries to bend to our will and we'll sanction them when they don't. And yet the United States, which is, as Martin Luther King said, the greatest purveyor of death and destruction, nothing happens to us. The world should be having a blockade, a boycott of the United States. We should have other countries putting sanctions done to the world.
Indeed. This is a really an important issue and an important part of the issue. And I want to, again, spend just another moment or two discussing it. Again, not about democracy, not about the form of government, but because the U.S. has economic and imperial designs on targeted countries. William Bloom, the author who lives here in Washington, D.C., wrote an amazing book called Killing Hope. Everybody should try to find that book and read it. It chronicles how the U.S. is engaged in regime change during the past 50 years. Bill Bloom is also a friend and someone who's really paid attention in a unique way. I want to read from that book about what happened to Iran after the U.S. CIA carried out the coup using economic destabilization tools. 1 year after the coup, the Iranian government completed a contract with an international consortium of oil companies. Among Iran's new foreign partners, the British lost the exclusive rights they had enjoyed previously being reduced now to a 40%. Another 40% went to American firms, the remaining to other countries. The British, however, received an extremely generous compensation for their former property. So here we have Britain and France, I mean, Britain and the United States, these oil companies. It's not Britain and America like we the people. These are the oil companies from these countries taking back Iran's oil. Iran lived in poverty at that time. I mean, the people were illiterate. I mean, not all of them, but there was huge illiteracy, huge poverty. Mossack Day wanted to use the oil to develop the country, to overcome poverty, to bring education and health care. American oil companies said, no, that's bad because it reduces our ownership. And so we're going to go to war against Mossack Day using economic tools. And again, it's always for a good reason. It's always for a noble cause, not just straight out exploitation.
Yeah, because who would like send their kids to join the U.S. military? Who would decide themselves to join the U.S. military if they were, you know, expecting to go die for the profits of an oil corporation? I mean, that would never fly. It would never become popular. And instead, you have to spin this narrative, you know, one that, you know, the United States just truly cares about democracy and freedom, especially in Iran. And then the other lie that this push by the Trump administration to withdraw from the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, the Iran nuclear deal, and, you know, to reset the United States on a path to war with the country, is that it's an expansionist power, that Iran, you know, it really truly turns things on its head. You know, Iran is an expansionist power. You know, they're trying to take over Yemen with the Houthis. They're trying to take over Lebanon with Hezbollah. They're trying to take over Iraq and Syria. But that's complete nonsense. I mean, there's an alliance of states and movements in the Middle East that are targeted by the most powerful empire to ever exist. And, you know, they stick together, but it's not the same thing as Iran saying we're going to try to take over everything and reconstitute, you know, an empire or something like that. You know, the raving fantasies of the right wing in the United States.
John, Walter was just talking about Chile. Salvador Allende, the president, was executed. They said he committed suicide, shot himself in the back 22 times or something.
Right.
Muammar Gaddafi lynched in the streets. Saddam Hussein, he went to the gallows. Mohamed Mossack Day, who was overthrown by the CIA in the coup that we're talking about, he was a little luckier, but he wasn't that lucky.
No, actually, he spent decades under house arrest, all those years under Shah Mohammad Reza Pahlavi. And after the Shah was overthrown, until his death, Mossadegh was under house arrest. He even wrote an autobiography from his home, in which he indicated that he was literally under house arrest in that he was not allowed to leave the confines of the four walls of that house. Believe me when I say that's worse than prison. Prison isn't as bad as that, because at least you can get out and get some fresh air and see the light of day. But the man was essentially psychologically tortured for the rest of his life.
Yeah, and for thousands of Iranians, they did lose their lives, the
yes.
ones who were even less fortunate. And here's what the New York Times, everybody, wrote about the CIA coup following the economic sanctions. Here's what they wrote in 1954, the New York Times. Quote, this is an editorial, underdeveloped countries with rich resources now have an object lesson in the heavy cost to be paid by one of their number, which goes berserk with fanatical nationalism, meaning wanting to nationalize your own oil resources.
Right.
And right, you get the last word. Go ahead in the last minute.
Well, I'm afraid we haven't changed too much from 1953 and 54 to right now, where the threat against the country of Iran still is there by the United States, and the potential threats that the United States does to other countries. We just hope that perhaps this, for another part of the world in Asia, that indeed the Trump administration will go ahead with the discussions with the North Koreans and hopefully resolve things through diplomatic means and come up with an agreement that Trump can see with that agreement that indeed the agreement that they have with the Iranians isn't so bad after all. In fact, it'll be pretty similar to what I think the international community can do with the North Koreans.
Yeah, and perhaps the reason Trump has a different pose towards North Korea is they do have nuclear weapons. I mean, it's, you know, that's sort of like on the surface, on the face, appears to be the case. The U.S. tells all these countries don't get nuclear weapons, but if they get them, actually they negotiate with them, perhaps. We don't know. We'll see how that plays out. Anyway, we're out of time. We've been joined from Connecticut by Colonel Ann Wright. Ann is a retired U.S. Army colonel, former U.S. State Department official in Afghanistan, and I would say one of the very, very few U.S. State Department officials who, in as a matter of principle, resigned in protest of the illegal U.S. invasion of Iraq. We've also been joined in studio by Walter Smolarek. He's a Sputnik News analyst and the producer of this show. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.